Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoyed the program. Ira Chernus was one of those invited to the Parliament of the World's Religions. His particular interest is religion and its influence on American foreign policy over the years. Ira Chernus, welcome to Sunday Night.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Well, you're somebody who's got a strong interest in America's influence on the culture of the world, particularly through foreign policy. How did the interest start? What was the background? Was your background in foreign policy or in religion?
No, I was trained as a historian of religions, did my PhD work actually in classical Jewish texts, but along the way as a young professor, I also got involved in the nuclear disarmament movement. I'm at the University of Colorado in Boulder, and it was just a few miles outside of Boulder that the United States government back in the early 50s built the Rocky Flats nuclear weapons plant. That's where all of the radioactive plutonium triggers for all of America's nuclear weapons were built until the late 1980s. And we would like to think that part of the reason they stopped that production there is because throughout the 1980s, thousands of us in the Denver-Boulder area consistently protested against nuclear weapons. Of course, we don't want those nuclear weapons made anywhere, but particularly in our own backyard. And so I got involved in that as a private citizen in the movement to abolish nuclear weapons. And that got me thinking about the ways in which nuclear weapons were functioning as a symbol that had really religious connotations. I wrote a book called Dr. Strange God, on the symbolic meaning of nuclear weapons, and talked about how, in many ways, nuclear weapons had come to be our primary symbol of infinite power. The way people used to talk about God, now people talked about nuclear weapons, the weapons that were going to either save us all or destroy us all. And, of course, my fear was that it was the destruction that was coming. I couldn't see anything saving about nuclear weapons, and so I joined the movement to protest against them, but also brought my personal political commitments and my academic work together. And that got me thinking about the larger issues of the way in which religious symbols, religious mythology, theological traditions and language have all work their way into the discourse about national security, about military, about war and peace, and about foreign policy in general in the history of the United States.
That was a particularly seminal moment you refer to, because it almost marked that Cold War period marked the beginning of the rise of what we'd call today the new right in American politics, and certainly in Western politics. One thinks of the Goldwater election, particularly against LBJ, and the significance that the bomb held in that election. And of course, that symbolism runs right through to Ronald Reagan and the use of ICBMs as sort of God's weapon against the might of the evil forces, the dark forces of the Soviet Empire. So the symbolism is not simply academic here.
No, it's very real, and the tragedy there is that Goldwater lost that election, was massively defeated by Lyndon Johnson, largely because Goldwater was perceived as the one who might use nuclear weapons, and then, merely 16 years later, Ronald Reagan runs as the one who is going to bring back nuclear weaponry as a symbol of American power, and he won. So massively, of course, intervening between there was the Vietnam War and the great fear, I think, of so many voters by the late 1970s is that the United States had shown itself to be weak. You know, the United States had never lost a war before, and the Vietnam War was a symbol for so many people of weakness in a country that always prided itself on its sense of strength, that we're God's chosen people, we're always supposed to win, God is on our side. Now we've lost, and then Reagan comes along and says he's going to bring back American power and therefore bring back American greatness. And this is all tied into a sense of manifest destiny, really, of what we call millennialism, the idea that America is the place where God will make his presence manifest on earth. Now, I want to hasten to say that there aren't too many Americans nowadays who use that kind of language explicitly. That kind of language was very, very common in the 19th century, let's say. But for the last 100 years or so, it's gone much more underground. You'll hear it sometimes on the religious right, but you know, when we talk about the religious right in the United States, we're talking about maybe 20% of the voters, maybe 25% tops. But that sense of American exceptionalism, that sense of American superiority, of American greatness, is generally now expressed much more in secular language, and yet it's this religious traditions beneath the surface.
It's also it's also expressed in terms of service, isn't it? A service to the world. Democracy is a gift to the world.
Very much so. And so it's very, very easy for people in the United States to assume that we have the right to be the world's indispensable nation, the world's only superpower, as they say, because we have a special virtue, because we have a special set of values that no other people have. This is commonly believed even among liberals in the United States. So this is not at all just the property of the religious right.
You've seen that, and you've studied that, the way that those images resonate through American history, even down to urban cultures today. And you presented a couple of very interesting case studies in one of the talks you gave, how even locally based urban cultures can take these symbols and recraft them and give them refreshed meaning for good or ill.
Yes, and what I was talking about here was a couple of cases where you have a particular religious community. I was talking in one case about the Methodists and the other case about American Jews, who are using the same set of symbols, but part of that community is using those symbols to support policies that I would call war policies, to support conflict, to support a sense of superiority. But within the same community, and here again I'm talking about Methodists and Jews as examples, but you could find this in any religious community, within the same community, the same traditions and the same symbolic resources are used by other people in that community on behalf of peace, on behalf of conflict resolution, to stand against policies of war and domination. And so we cannot at all say that certain religions in the United States are more prone to war and conflict, others more in support of peace. Within each religious community, you find the whole political spectrum represented.
You're on Sunday nights on ABC Radio around Australia and via the web to the world. Our guest is Ira Chernus, a scholar of the connections in American religious history between religion and foreign policy. Let's talk some more about the powerful religious symbolism that's resonated through American culture. We mentioned the nuclear symbol. You also mentioned something called Manifest Destiny, which Americans would be familiar with. Many outside the United States are not so familiar with. It comes right back to the Founding Fathers with this idea of America in some ways being the light on the hill, the beacon unto the nations. The biblical resonances for Jews, Christians, Muslims are very strong there. American Jewish tradition of the Golden Land is another one that strikes there, that gives this idea of America having both a duty and an obligation, as though God set them apart. We even have American religions, of course, uniquely shaped. Mormonism is a Latter-day Saints, an expression of that American frontier culture.
That's true, but there are these two very distinct traditions that are always in tension with each other. You know, the tradition of the city on the hill is a tradition that says that we must be an example. And in that famous sermon going back to 1630, the Puritan leader John Winthrop said, we must be knit together as one person, as one body, helping each other. And we're going to show the world what it looks like to have a society of mutual cooperation, a society where we really all feel that we're parts of the same organism, and we trust that other people will see us and want to be like us. That's very different than the Manifest Destiny, because the Manifest Destiny tradition says we're going to go out and force the rest of the world to be like us. One famous scholar has labeled those the exemplary tradition and the emissary tradition. And there are a lot of us who would like to go back to exemplary tradition, a lot of us, shall I say, on the liberal and left side of the political spectrum, who say that we've done far too much of being emissaries in the sense of trying to go out and tell the rest of the world how they ought to live their lives, which always turns out to be, of course, like us, let's share our resources with the rest of the world, but let's let other people decide what's best for them in their use of resources, and let us, if we're going to make a contribution to the world, let it be that we make our own American society one of more cooperation and more sharing of resources.
When did those traditions begin to diverge? I mean, one still sees residue of the old Commonwealth tradition. You see it particularly in the Commonwealth of Virginia and in Washington, D.C., the great institutions, the Smithsonian, the Library of Congress. These are open and public institutions. When did this idea of the Commonwealth begin to recede, and the idea of the strength of the individual and the individual carrying that strong manifest message begin to take over? Is there a period?
Well, again, I think they've both been there from the beginning. I know so little about Australian history, but I suspect it's true here as in the United States that there are plenty of people who arrived on your shores because they were interested in their own personal wealth and they were interested in their own personal aggrandizement, and whatever sharing they had to do was only under duress and out of necessity, but at the same time also people who understood that it's only when we all share our resources and help each other. And I suspect that those two traditions are interwoven in your history, just as they are in ours, really from the very beginning. I think what's new, relatively new, in American history, U.S. history, is a tradition that emerged. Well, I'm going to, in a few years, I'm going to be publishing a book on Franklin Roosevelt, one that I'm writing now, about his foreign policy, suggesting that in Roosevelt's time, for the first time, we had yet a third tradition that that America's real role in the world was to prevent dangerous change around the world. See, the Manifest Destiny tradition, for all of its excesses, for all of its the terrible things that were done in the name of Manifest Destiny, it was really about dynamic change. It was about moving out to the frontier, about actively going out to transform the world.
And it peaked under the previous Roosevelt. Of course, Teddy Roosevelt did it not, or one particular aspect of it.
Or others would say it was really under Woodrow Wilson. But when Wilson's plan for the League of Nations, for the war to end war, pretty much collapsed from out under him, for a whole host of reasons, within 20 years or so, as the war clouds are brewing in Europe again, American foreign policymakers are becoming much more aware of what they see as the dangers around the world to the United States. And partly, at least, in order to persuade the American people to support American involvement in the global war, Franklin Roosevelt creates this image in his political rhetoric of the safe American neighborhood, the safe American home. And he's saying, we may have to fight this war, but we're doing it in the name of preventing dangerous change. And although he's still using a lot of that old rhetoric, all of the themes that we've been talking about are all still very much alive in American political rhetoric. But I think the dominant one, beginning with Roosevelt, but especially in the era of the Cold War, right, where the Cold War is about we're going to contain the communists, we're going to prevent them from crossing over the Iron Curtain, it all becomes about preventing dangerous change. And American political leaders have competed, and I would argue still compete to this day, to put themselves forward as the one who can keep Americans safe by preventing dangerous change rather than by promoting positive change. And that's yet another tension in the political thinking, the political life of America, that is very much with us.
Of course, all of this stands in the light of a seminal event, that's 9/11, when two aircraft crashed into the Twin Towers, changed the dynamics not only of American politics, but world politics. And the natural question from there is, how does this fit, the Bush-Cheney paradigm fit what you're talking about?
I wrote a whole book on the subject, so I don't know how many hours you'll give me here. But my own view is that Bush masterfully used the traditional language of dynamic change, that America was going to bring democracy to the world. He masterfully used that language to justify policies that were really about preventing what he saw, what many people saw, as uncontrollable pockets of threat to the United States and to the global system of multinational corporate capitalism that the United States policies are really devoted to supporting. And it's important to remember that on a few occasions, Bush slipped up and he said, we're never going to win this war on terrorism. The best we can hope for is a holding action. I think that the policy is very much a policy of containment against the, quote, terrorists, in the same way that the U.S. was devoted to containing communism for so many decades during the Cold War. And it appears to me that Obama has pretty much decided, for now at least, to continue those policies of trying to contain the terrorist threat, but accepting the fact that there will always be people using violence to resist the American efforts to gain hegemony around the world.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia and via the web to the world. John Cleary with you. Let's talk about the civil rights era, how the sort of paradigms that you work with are reflected in the civil rights era. Because the civil rights era, again, there are deep religious issues, religious imagery here. You have the image of the crucifixion, the fiery cross, reaching back into the Presbyterian covenantal tradition. You have blacks calling on the story of Exodus and the freedom from slaves. You have the white races seeking sort of protection under God, as if the white race has been gifted particularly by God. These issues resonate very powerfully at a visceral level. It's connected very much to faith.
And as is so common, you have both the white racists and the civil rights movement, blacks and whites together, using so much the same religious imagery. The fiery cross is the symbol of the Ku Klux Klan, the white racists, but also Onward Christian Soldiers is a song of the civil rights movement as well. But it seems to me that, as is so often the case, the same religious symbols can be used either to divide people or to bring them together. And I think at the deepest level, the civil rights movement was such a cataclysm for American culture, because Americans were so accustomed, as I think is true in your Australian history as well, to the racial divide being the most obvious symbol of separation, of clear-cut boundaries upon which the culture is founded. And that's something I find in my work over and over again, whether I'm studying religion or politics, that there's for so many people, there's a deep-seated need to have some sense of clear-cut boundaries, clear-cut divisions, separations between us and them, between good and evil. And it's acted out in our history, and I think in yours so visibly, in the racial divide, right, between darker-skinned people, lighter-skinned people. And when that boundary line began to be crossed in the United States, it was not merely the integration of the races, but for an awful lot of white people, it was a sense that if that boundary line could begin to dissolve, then all boundary lines could be called into question. And then following immediately upon that, we have the Vietnam War, right, where the boundary line between America as the good guys and our military enemies as the bad guys was radically called into question, so that for millions of us, we could no longer believe in that boundary line. And by the 1970s, we're beginning to question all boundary lines. And that's when many American people get frightened. And that's what allows Ronald Reagan and the religious right and the neoconservatives to come to power, because what they're really all about is reinstituting a whole series of boundary lines. They can no longer reinstitute racial segregation in its old-fashioned sense, but they can bring back in a more subtle way a sense of white privilege, of white superiority, but more obviously, they bring back the boundary line between capitalism and communism, between the free world and the Soviet-led communist world, and they give people a sense of, I think, a false sense of reassurance that there are clear-cut boundaries on which they can build their lives, and that's still an issue that we're dealing with every day here in the United States.
Let's turn then to the latest iteration of that drama, Barack Obama. Barack Obama seems to bring together several of those strands you've spoken of. You have the black-white colour divide. You go from an era not too long ago when marriage between black and white was labelled miscegenation, and as miscegenation had the biblical sanction of being a sin. So this wasn't just something you didn't do, it was against the law of God. We've gone from that to Barack Obama not only representing the triumph of the collapse of the colour divide, but also the resurrection of the ideal of the Commonwealth, of civil society as being a noble thing, that government is a positive agent. How can I serve my country? There's resonances of JFK that many people, but he's reaching back again to that, to Roosevelt, and perhaps even earlier to other traditions about the nature of the Commonwealth.
I should say first that I worked very actively on Obama's campaign, but at the same time, I never expected him to revolutionize American life. I didn't expect him to solve all our problems. I only expected him to be better than the alternative, John McCain. And I believe has turned out to be better than McCain, but he has disappointed many of us in a number of ways. He certainly has kept the Wall Street tycoons in business. And so in many ways, he's compromised with the private health insurance companies and the private healthcare industry in ways that disappointed many of us. So that ideal of the Commonwealth that he talks about so much, I'm afraid he doesn't walk the walk nearly as much as a lot of us would like. Still, many of us are happy that it's the Democrats, not the Republicans, in power. But one of the things we've seen clearly, especially in this debate about the health care issue, is the way in which so many people have been frightened by a black man in the White House. That's the clearest visual symbol of that blurring of boundaries I was talking about a few minutes ago. And it has brought out a kind of conservative backlash that we saw in the most recent elections in the U.S., in some major elections for the governors of big states. In my own hometown, I live in a little sort of typical middle American town in Colorado, where the liberals had taken over the city council for a couple of years, and now the conservatives are back in power. So I think that there's a sense among some number of Americans that perhaps the pendulum has swung a little bit too far in the liberal direction, although in the circles I go in, we still don't feel it's far enough. But we're always grappling with this fear of change. And we're always grappling with this question of how far can we go in blurring the boundaries that used to give us a sense of solidity in our culture, used to give us a sense that we had a firm foundation. And whenever change becomes rapid, you're always dealing with a blurring of boundaries, and that always creates a certain amount of fear.
Where are the religious communities now in that debate? You've almost seen the eclipse of what was called the religious right, and the sort of religious progressives back in favour. But religious communities are at once agents of consolidation, they represent the consolidation of tradition, yet at the same time bridges to change. That is, the you must be prepared to accept the stranger, to accept the new things, that change is part of that. Where do you see the religious symbols and elements working around these issues at the moment, particularly as reflected in the groups you study and work with?
Well, this goes back to the point I made earlier, that within any religious community, you're going to find the whole spectrum. You're going to find some people who are going to rely on their religious symbols as borders, as demarcations of clear-cut separations and oppositions, whether it's between nations, between races, between good and evil, between virtue and sin. You're going to find other people within the same community who use the same symbols to talk about more of a sense of community, more of a sense of creating bridges rather than creating barriers between people. I think that the so-called demise of the religious right in the U.S. has been overstated. It's still a potent force, but within the religious right, you have a broader spectrum even now. Most clearly, I think, on the environmental issues, where some significant groups among the evangelical Christians are beginning to understand that it's in the ecology that we see most clearly that everything is interconnected, that all of the separations we try to create, all of the boundary lines we try to draw are really artificial because everything interacts with everything. Even on the religious right, people are beginning to understand that. There is, though, clearly a resurgence of what I guess could be called the religious left, of progressive political movements rooted in the churches and the synagogues and the mosques. That's beginning to become more visible. It's always been there, but it's becoming more visible in the United States.
And I guess the real question is which one hooks, which one bites ultimately, isn't it? Which one people feel most grounded in to actually give their lives a new sense of coherent meaning?
And the answer is both, right? That that people feel empowered to act politically, both at the progressive and the conservative ends of the spectrum, by their religious faith. And certainly here in this Parliament of World Religions that brought me to Melbourne, I think generally the spirit is a very politically progressive one, great concerns about world peace, about saving the environment, about justice for peoples around the world. And it's really inspiring to see how this goes all over the world. And yet when I go back to the United States, I know that I have to deal with a culture whose deepest roots are very much individualistic and very much about drawing boundaries between us and them, very much about the fear of change, of excessive change in the world, and people drawing on biblical symbols and other religious symbols to motivate them to work against these kinds of progressive changes. And I just think that that tension, which is rooted in the very beginnings of our history, of the white history in the United States, is going to go on at least as long as there's white people in the United States. I suppose that's going to be for a long time.
One could make an observation about the growing Spanish culture, but that would take us in another direction entirely. We've almost run out of time, Ira Chernus. A year or so ago, a small book got some publicity around the world called The Puritan Gift, in which two older businessmen were looking, reflecting back on their careers and outlining how important the sort of Puritan tradition had been in American commerce up until the time of the emergence of the MBA and all of that. There was this in the religious communities, one could almost come back to where we started this conversation and say, well, if starting from the Pilgrim Fathers, maybe up to Jonathan Edwards and those great sort of first evangelical revivals, you say, to what extent is that strand still evident in American culture? And what would Jonathan Edwards make of the America he sees today?
I hesitate to speak for Jonathan Edwards. I can say that I'm just finishing up a course I teach on religion and U.S. nationalism. And of course, we start with the Puritans, and we find that Puritan traditions tend to run throughout the history of the United States. But the Puritans were such diverse people that there's no simple answer to that. They were pretty acquisitive, greedy, individualistic people, but at the same time, they had a strong sense of community. And so maybe the ultimate lesson we learn is that all of the kind of simple answers that we would like to give to questions like that always turn out to be far more complicated than we would like them to be. But the one thing I think I would say is that the Puritans did have a sense of mission. They had a sense that they were going to transform the world. Some scholars think that they were trying to create something brand new. Some scholars think they were trying to return the world to some imagined pure state. But it was a very dynamic society. And I come back to the point that since the era of World War II and the early Cold War days, although we still use the language of dynamic change, particularly our political leaders do, our writers do, to talk about the United States, there's a much stronger impulse, I think, that's been dominant in our culture, to fear change, to try to prevent change. Obama came along, used the language of hope, used the language of change, said we can change the world. And yet in many ways, we see his policies also are really about preventing dangerous change, about maintaining stability, about trying to get control over these uncontrollable forces of change around the world, which I have to say personally, I think is doomed to fail. Because here in this Parliament of World Religions, seeing the genuine diversity in the world, the idea that any one country could get control of all the forces of change around the world, as American leaders have dreamed of doing for the last 5 or 6 decades, I think it's just a pipe dream. I think it's just an impossible dream and a dangerous dream. That's my personal opinion.
Ira Chernus, thanks so much for joining us on Sunday Night.
Thank you very much.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday Night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/Sunday Nights with an S. Thank you for listening.